A tornado devastated Parkersburg in 2008. Fire gutted Grinnell in 1889. And Belle Plaine, like so many other small towns, was deeply hurt by the farm crisis. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we continue our series on Iowa towns and cities. Today, communities shaped by disaster. We'll start in Parkersburg, 4 years after the EF5 tornado that destroyed nearly 200 homes. We'll look back on the flooding of 1993 and how towns recovered from that crisis. We'll go back in history to talk about two disasters that nearly wiped Grinnell off the map, and then we'll explore the effects of economic disaster. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we continue our summer series on Iowa towns and cities with communities that have been shaped by disaster. Later in the hour, we'll talk about the devastating floods of 1993 and how communities recovered from that crisis. We'll go back in time and talk about two disasters, a tornado and a fire that almost obliterated Grinnell. And then we'll talk about the effects of economic crisis. Belle Plaine, like so many small towns, was badly hurt by the farm crisis. We'll explore the long road to recovery for a small community in Iowa hurt by economic disaster. We're going to start the hour in Parkersburg. In May of 2008, an EF5 tornado hit the town, destroying nearly 200 homes, killing 7 people. While Parkersburg was not the only place hurt by that storm, it was the town hardest hit. Chris Luring is here with us today. He's the city clerk of Parkersburg. Hello, Chris.
Hi there, ma'am.
Welcome back to the show. And John Thompson is also with us. He's the superintendent of Applington Parkersburg Community Schools. Hello, John.
Good morning.
I know you've spent a lot of time thinking about and talking about the events of May 2008, but let's go back in time, not to the storm, but to the day after the storm. Chris, can you tell me what your impressions were looking at the devastation?
You know, looking at the devastation back then is hard to believe, and it's still almost unimaginable. I mean, it's very difficult to describe the sheer extent of what 43 seconds of strong wind can do. And literally wipe your town off the map and make it so that you don't even remember what street or you don't even know what street you live on. I mean, literally, it's hard to describe and hard to imagine. And other cities were hit by EF5s last year. And when I looked at some of those pictures, it looked very similar and brought up some really, really bad memories of that day.
I'm sure. John, what was going through your mind?
Well, I'd have to say almost identical to what Chris said, but to kind of go beyond that a little bit was the people that I was able to witness that following day, our own people scurrying around trying to save their belongings, and then the beginning of support and those people arriving. So the devastation was obvious and clear, but what kind of sticks in my mind is the people showing up to help and our own people trying to make decisions.
There were people speculating right after that storm that Parkersburg may not be able to recover from a disaster of that magnitude. In those early days, were you even able to think about rebuilding and moving on, Chris?
You know, there was no doubt in my mind. And if you're from Parkersburg or if you're from any town that's destroyed by a storm, the last thing that's going to define you is that storm. And, you know, I had no doubt in my mind. And there was a core group of individuals like John, Coach Thomas, Dave Meyer at the school, our city officials and mayor and some of our church leaders and many, many, many people who had no doubt whatsoever that not only were we going to recover, but we wanted to be a model of recovery for other small towns who possibly were going to be hit in the future. And so I don't want to sound arrogant or conceited at all by the fact that we had a lot of confidence. And, you know, what we were looking at was pretty devastating. But we had to have some hope, and we had to have faith that we could come back and we could bounce back. And everybody did their part in that recovery, and even setting the goal and the standard high to get us back to the point where we could be a model in the future.
John, were there families that gave up and moved away?
We had two students, when it was all said and done, who left the district. And that's very minimal, of course. And their reason for leaving was that they were renters. And when you have that many homes destroyed, finding a place to rent was nearly impossible. So we ended up losing two students. I'm happy to report that 4 years removed that our enrollment has, since that date, has actually increased each year.
I have been to Parkersburg fairly recently, and when you travel into the town, of course, you can tell that there is brand new siding on so many of the homes, and of course, some of the homes themselves are brand new. As the town was being rebuilt, what was that like? There must have been so much work going on all at the same time, Chris.
You know, it's hard to put that into context, too. The best way I can describe it is about a year later, we were rebuilding our playground. And our playground designer, who builds playgrounds all over Iowa, all over the Midwest, one of the guys just said, you know, what's wrong with your children? They don't seem to be even aware of the big equipment, the heavy equipment that's working around them. And I says, they're not. They're completely desensitized to the trucks, to the backup alarms, to the heavy loaders, to the big equipment, and all the work that goes on. And that gentleman almost got sad by that reality. But there's so much work going on, and we wanted to have a fast progress in the right way, and we really did. But there still is work going on in Parkersburg. I'm not sure when you were here last. We have some streets being ripped up and still repaired, so the recovery still continues.
Yeah, I was there almost exactly a year ago.
Okay, so now it's tore up a little bit more than then. But it is. We've had people comment coming into City Hall that aren't aware of the tornado, that you guys have a development, right? I mean, this is just a development, and then you tell them the stories and show them the pictures, and they're just shocked by how many houses have been rebuilt and how our school just sits on top of the hill just like a bright light, just as a brand-new building, as a brand-new structure for all our students.
John, can you give me your impression of that time with all of the rebuilding, all of the work being done?
You know, it does kind of become your way of life for a year plus, definitely. The school is kind of unique. Following the tornado, we had over 200 students who lost their home completely in that 40-some seconds. But there again, we had 600-plus students who did not. And those students, upon hearing about the tornado, arrived to the school. And the question started immediately, are we going to have to go to a neighboring school district? Is our school done forever? And so we made that conscious choice, really minutes after the tornado and days, that we were not only going to rebuild, but we were going to rebuild in the same location. I don't think I realized how naive I was at the time making that statement that we'd be back in our building in a year. But it was the right message for our town to hear. It was definitely the right message for our students to hear. And, you know, we pulled it off, so we're pretty proud of that. The only thing I'd say about the rebuilding process is I learned quickly to kind of stop and celebrate the successes. And sometimes they're pretty minor. When we put up lights for our ball fields, how exciting that was for me to actually see a structure going way up in the air again in an area that had been leveled. So you learn to kind of stop and pause every now and then and celebrate what you're doing. And it was a real positive experience in the end.
The schools were instrumental not just in rebuilding the community, but in helping people emotionally move on. You had teams of counselors come in to help families and children deal with what they had just been through and all of the fears that ignites in children. Can you give me your perspective now on how time has helped the kids deal with that disaster? Because I'm sure there are many that still think of it and are still frightened.
One thing I learned from experts early on is that the emotional strain on a family and on the students can not really show itself until a full 18 months after the incident, which was surprising to me, but you know it was really true. We found that out a good year and a half following the tornado, that there were students still sleeping on the floors of their mom and dad, wanting to get in bed with them, having some anxieties. And so it's an ongoing process. It's not just the first week or two following the disaster. It's something that you have to be conscious of. So we had trained our staff. We had a number of experts come in and provide guidance to us. We had good people in place already who really took on a extra role in their life as counselors, clergymen, different folks coming in to help us. But it's been a long process. And I think here in the end, we look back at it and feel pretty good about how we handled it. I think our kids have come through this and are better people for it now.
Of course, just a year after the storm, Ed Thomas, the beloved football coach who did so much to help with the recovery effort after that tornado, was murdered. and the nation just mourned for Parkersburg again. That must have been such a blow inside the town and inside the schools too, John.
Oh, definitely. We had 22 students who witnessed that shooting, and I can't even begin to describe what that must have been like for them. But it was for our entire staff, adults and students, what a traumatic experience that was. The trial that came about a year later was a very traumatic experience, and you put all that after a tornado. I'm not sure if the tornado helped us prepare for that. It kind of seemed like it on some respects. But that was blow number two for sure. And there again, I was really proud of the way people responded community-wide, school-wide, even around the region to provide support for us. I think we handled that as well as we could and could imagine as well.
We've talked about how Parkersburg looks today with a lot of new construction, a lot of new siding on houses, not a lot of big trees, I'd have to say. How do you think the town is different now than it was before May of 2008? Chris?
You know, I would say Parkersburg is a very appreciative place. And granted, we have high standards and we expect things to be done right, but I'd say we have a greater appreciation for family. I'd say we have a greater appreciation for people, and maybe less of an appreciation for things that don't really matter. And that wasn't just for the folks that lost their homes or that had damaged property. That's for everybody in the area. I think our kids, and John kind of hit on it well, our high school kids or our middle school kids, I think they grew up really, really fast also. And so they're different. It's interesting talking to some of the kids before and then after. It's like I'm talking to an adult now. And I think they also have a greater appreciation for their family, for them, for themselves, for all the things that people did coming in to help. And so many kids and so many schools and so many individuals and companies came in from all over Iowa and all over the nation to help us uninvited, just because that's the right thing to do. And that's a great example of how we take care of each other in Iowa, in the United States. And how we should value people, not things, as much.
John, we just have a couple of seconds left. How do you think the town is different today?
Well, you know, I guess I'll focus on the school a little bit. I agree with everything Chris said. He said it very well. For the school, the adults in the school, and for the kids in the school, I think it made us more cohesive. I think Chris kind of mentioned this, but you don't sweat the little things nearly as much. Kids have tremendous pride in our communities, Appleton and Parkersburg, and the school, and it was taken to a new level following the tornado. Now, I would never recommend a disaster to have some of these positives come out, but looking back at it now, without a doubt, there's some positives that come out of a terrible situation like this, and we're proud of those.
John Thompson, thank you so much.
You bet.
John Thompson is the superintendent of Appleton Parkersburg Community Schools. And Chris Luring, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Chris Luring is the city clerk of Parkersburg. Coming up in just a moment, we'll look back on the floods of 1993. We're talking about towns shaped by disaster today. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about communities that have been shaped by disaster, part of our summer series on Iowa towns and cities. Later today at noon on River to River, we'll be talking about manufacturing towns in Iowa. Right now, we're going to go back in time to the summer of 1993, and that summer was the exact opposite of this summer. That summer was cool, it was cloudy, it was rainy. And the rains, of course, just kept coming and coming. The flooding that Iowa experienced that year was unprecedented. And with me right now to help us look back is Bob Libra. He is a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Iowa City. Hello, Bob.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And let's talk about that summer, because it really was unlike anything anyone had seen before.
Yes, it really was. Yes, it really was. You know, we've had floods since then. We've had floods before then. But really nothing like that in terms of the scope and scale and duration. virtually all of the state was affected. And really all of the upper Midwest, 9 to 10 states suffered very large damages. I think they put the final total bill at $15 to $20 billion across the region. Big flooding on the Missouri and Mississippi River main streams all the way down to St. Louis. There was points in time where St. Louis was very, very nervous. They, a large chunk of St. Louis could have gone under very, very readily. So, and the folks who do the stream predictions and were looking at flood forecasts at one point in time had 600 river flood forecast points above flood stage. Nothing has really happened like that before. And the other fact was the duration. I mean, some flooding was happening up north. They had a really big snowpack in the woods in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Flooding was going on in April, in May. In June, it started to rain incredibly down here. July got worse, and August kept going. It backed off a bit, but everything was so soaked by then. And really, the last big rivers in Iowa didn't fall completely under flood stage until October 1st. So it just kind of kept happening and kept coming.
Well, and what I remember about it is that everything was flooded. I lived in Cedar Falls then, and Cedar Falls and Waterloo were completely flooded because of the Cedar River. And I remember that although everything was flooded and we kind of felt like it was as bad as it could be, it just kept getting worse.
It really did. And I can remember some of the local news folks, weather guys getting on and just going, I have nothing to say here. It's just going to keep coming. This weather system is set up. It's going to keep coming. And yeah, so we would have rains that were 5, 6, 7 inches in a day and a half. They'd hit that upper end of the Cedar River and come through Charles City and Cedar Falls and Waterloo. I believe it was 4th of July weekend, the Coralville Reservoir topped for the first time, and soon Iowa City and the University of Iowa campus were underwater. Then, you know, shift over to the middle of Iowa, 7 or 8 inches down the Raccoon River. The coup de grace, Des Moines Water Works, right, goes under, and suddenly 250,000 people are without water. The big hospitals in Des Moines are making their own water, making their own power. And it just went back and forth. And so you never really knew who was going to get it next. All you could tell was it just kept coming.
Right. And you couldn't travel in Iowa. That was the other thing that I remember. You couldn't get from one place to another because roads were flooded almost anywhere you went.
Yeah, it really was. If you I can imagine what a DOT internet site would have looked like on road closures had there been one around back in 1993.
Right, right.
We didn't quite have all that technology then. But yeah, parts of the interstates were closed. Often I-80 was, I-35 between Ames and Des Moines a couple of times. Ames and Iowa State, frankly, flooded like 3 times during that.
Right.
You know, once every couple of months.
Right. Well, and I knew people at the time who were flooded into Ames. They couldn't even get out of Ames.
Exactly.
And it's not they weren't underwater right where they were, but there was no exit. There was no way to get out.
Yeah, yeah.
So that flood, of course, is the flood that really sets the precedent for flooding in Iowa. But as you mentioned, we have had serious floods since then. One of the wonderful things about a flood is that the floodwaters do recede, but of course leave behind so much damage. But also, we have to learn lessons from what happened so we can prevent that kind of flooding from happening in the future. What have towns been able to do to protect themselves from that kind of flooding?
Well, you know, it's one of the unfortunate lessons of floods throughout history is that we don't learn the lessons well enough. A lot of people took the floods of 1993 pretty seriously, though. They saw how bad it could get.
But at the same time, we thought that it was a once-in-a-lifetime kind of flood. It was a 500-year flood, and we wouldn't see something like that again. Did that help some people dismiss the concerns?
Well, yeah, you know, dismiss it or go, we've seen the worst. Let's plan for that. Well, okay, but that doesn't mean it can't get worse. And I think a lot of people, you know, there's a problem. It's easy to look back and criticize. You have to build to some standard. You have to come to some level. So a lot of people use that 1993 flood as, if we can withstand that, we'll take anything. Turns out that wasn't true. And Iowa City learned that lesson again. Cedar Rapids learned it. It can always get worse. Maybe that's the big lesson we have learned. But now, after the 2008 flood, I think those lessons have sank in better. There has been more attention to what we really have to do to manage the water coming out of watersheds, what we need to do coming through cities, how we can really keep critical infrastructure out of those floodplains. There's been some public dollars put into floodplain mapping like there has not been before. And so we learn the lessons of floods slowly, but we are learning them surely.
With redevelopment and future development in a lot of these towns that experienced the flood of 1993 and subsequent floods, do you think that that has influenced the way that towns are growing?
I think so. I think at a certain point that property down along the river doesn't look as attractive anymore. It now has a history behind it. And so folks are looking at, well, what can we put there that we really don't care too much if it gets wet? So green space, ball fields, you know, things that, yeah, you got to clean them up when it's done, but that's all, a much simpler task. And so I think we're trying to, you know, start working that way. Let it get wet, let it dry out, get the sand off, put it back to work.
Well, if you travel along any of these rivers that flooded in 1993, you can definitely see changes in how the homes look now as opposed to before, because in many places, all of the homes have been put up on big cement blocks or on stilts. So homeowners, in addition to communities, have had to change their ways of life.
They have. And in the countryside, you know, actually one of the things that did come out of the flood of 93 was the stretch of the Iowa River from, say, Marshalltown down towards Belle Plaine and the Amana colonies. Agricultural land that flooded a lot, quite often. That's been slowly working into easements and, you know, the Iowa River Greenbelt. That's been a very big success story. It's not right there in town, and it doesn't have to do with, you know, flooding the hospital or a new apartment building or something. But it is contributing to holding the water and from taking that agricultural land out of production when it was out of production quite often anyway. So slowly but surely, we're making progress on it all.
So the state is really still being shaped by the floods of 1993.
I think so. They're in the back of the mind. We will have bigger floods inevitably in every place that was flooded there then. The one thing that makes it the unique event that may take an awful long time, even from a geologist's point of view, to come back is that scope, scale, and duration.
Bob, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bob Libra is a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Iowa City. And now we're going to go further back in time to the 1880s, to a time when a disaster really could wipe a town off the map for good. Grinnell suffered two terrible disasters in a short period of time. And although the town recovered and endured, it was not easy. Frank Heath is here with us now. He's a historian and a retired teacher from Grinnell. Hello, Frank.
Hello.
We're going to start with a terrible disaster that happened in 1882, the tornado of 1882. But just before that, describe what Grinnell was like at that time.
It was a town of about 3,000 people. It was a railroad center, and it was a real agricultural center. There were many things happening here. It was actually far more bustling town than it is now, although we bustle pretty well. There was just a great deal happening.
And tell me about Grinnell College at that time. The college was already established, right?
It was, but it was known as Iowa College. And there were really two main recitation buildings, known as Central College and West College. They were three-story buildings. One was 50 by 95 feet, and the other was 42 by 80 feet. They were substantial buildings. There were a few other college outbuildings, but those were the two main buildings that held classes.
And this tornado struck in 1882. What happened?
June 17, 1882, about 8:45 p.m. The weather had been very, very hot, and toward dusk, there was a real coppery hue in the sky. And the very first warning that anyone had, because there was were no warnings available as far as radio and things like that, was the sound of several trains coming at the same time. And then the storm hit, and in no more than 10 minutes, 120 buildings, which are at least 20% of the houses in town, were just smashed. There's very little left but the foundations. Houses were crumbled like matchsticks. And people, in fact, were picked up and carried for long distances. The paper said that Henry Pittman said he seemed to go up, up, as though he would never stop, then down until it seemed he would never get back, and then he knew no more for some time.
Oh.
Obviously, he survived, but some 35 to 40 people were killed that night. There was as many as 100 were felt to be killed and, you know, die from injuries later. At the college, those big recitation buildings were just destroyed, just laid out as if they hadn't been there except for piles of brick and mortar. There was one meeting going on at the time, and those students were later found buried under rubble in the basement. They survived. There were only two students killed. 13 of them were dug out, and they were still alive. But the storm was... There's no way to tell what it was as far as an EF rating, but it had to be just severe.
Certainly. Well, and we were talking earlier in the hour about Parkersburg in modern day getting hit by a very similar storm, a similar amount of damage. But, of course, the world comes to your doorstep now when you have a disaster in a town like that. What kind of assistance came to Grinnell in 1882?
Well, it came in many ways. J.B. Grinnell, who had founded the town, a very prominent name in Iowa, had many contacts back east being mainly New England, and he appealed to them right away, and $40,000 came from them. But in all, about $150,000 was contributed to the town. Iowa Governor Sherman made an appeal saying funds could be sent to J.B. Grinnell, who was entirely trustworthy. And in all, maybe $250,000 came in aid in one form or another. Several lumber companies from Davenport sent lumber, and some came from as far away as Minnesota. And it's interesting that local towns donated their July 4th funds, money that they had set aside for celebration. They sent that to Grinnell.
Wow.
And help came in other ways. Iowa City, for instance, sent barrels of crackers, a large cheese, 3 dozen hams, 4 dozen cans of peaches, 4 dozen salmon, and 4 dozen mackerel. The newspaper reported that, among other things.
Did the town population decline a lot after that? Were a lot of people who just left and rebuilt elsewhere?
No, I don't think so. 20% of the houses were gone, and originally Grinnell said that our finest houses had been wiped out. But they were rebuilt in at least one instance, people didn't know where the wood pile had gone. Years later, they found their wood pile had been used to build the house next door. but I don't think it declined that way.
Now, just a few years later, in 1889, there was a terrible fire. What happened?
That was June 12, same month, but in 1889. And I mentioned that the railroads were active here. There was a Rock Island switch engine working, and sparks from that set the cupola atop the grain elevator on fire. There was a stiff wind, and the grain elevator was soon in flames, and that went right into the business district, called the commercial block because it was on Commercial Street. The alarm was sounded by steam engine whistles, and the whistle on the Randolph header works. The header was a grain harvesting machine. Both the fire department and the newspaper offices were in that commercial block, and the fire company fought the fire, pumping water from the cistern under the fire department until the flames were so great that they couldn't handle it. They had to get out. People realized that that whole block was going to go, the whole commercial block, which had some 54 businesses in it. So people began to empty the stores and the offices. They carried everything they could lift across the street into the park. Newspaper, of course, with the linotypes, you couldn't lift those. But they did save their subscription list, which turned out to be pretty important. And display cases from a jewelry store went into the park, along with what the newspaper said were those wonderful machines for grinding out milkshakes. So I don't know how recent those were. One man went into Johnson's drugstore. He came out with an armful of baseballs, and he stood throwing them into the park, which sounds like a good way to save baseballs.
I guess so. There were 40 buildings destroyed in that fire?
There weren't 40 buildings. The block had probably 15 or 20 buildings. Some were small wood structures that were later torn down to try to keep that fire from spreading. Another man was carrying some chairs down the stairs from a second floor in order to save them, get them across into the park. And then he went back up and he threw a mirror out the second-story window. So kind of strange things were happening.
Well, I'm sure at a time like that it was difficult to think straight. But then the town did come back from that as well. And, of course, we have Grinnell as we know it today. Frank Heath, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Frank Heath is a historian and a retired teacher from Grinnell. He also plays trombone with the Prairie Jewel Dixieland Band of Grinnell. Coming up in just a moment, we'll continue our conversation about towns shaped by disaster with a conversation about Belle Plaine and the farm crisis of the 1980s. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, our summer series on Iowa towns and cities continues. We're talking this hour about towns that have been shaped by disaster. We've focused so far on physical disasters, tornadoes, floods, fire. But one of the worst disasters to ever strike Iowa struck in the 1980s, the farm crisis. We'll talk more about what happened in a moment with Paul Lasley of Iowa State University. But first, a case study, Belle Plaine, Iowa. Hello, Dave Fish.
Hi, how are you folks?
Great. Dave Fish is the mayor of Belle Plaine. And Dave, give me an idea of what Belle Plaine was like before the farm crisis.
Well, I think if you go back to the late 70s, early 80s, you saw a still vibrant Main Street, town that had numerous things to offer. At that time, I think there were 3 auto dealerships in town. There were probably still 5 or 6 car dealerships. I think as a college student, I remember 8 bars being on Main Street. All the storefronts were filled, and all those positives going on there. I think the farm crisis of the 80s definitely affected the population in Belle Plaine, because we have a large agricultural involvement with this town. But I think at the same time, maybe you go into the 90s and the thing that so many small towns in the Belle Plaine were fighting was declining population and dealing with competition from the large cities. And at that time, gasoline was still pretty cheap, so it was pretty easy for people to do their shopping in, say, a Cedar Rapids or an Iowa City. And I think as a result, you saw stores close on Main Street, nobody coming in to fill those stores. We saw an older population of store owners who retired with no one who wanted to take on the demanding schedule that they had, and especially trying to compete. So we lost men's clothing stores, women's clothing stores. A number of the bars closed. We saw a pharmacy close. And a combination of things. I think you can look at the farm crisis, but I think maybe the mobility of our shoppers to go to the big cities was even a bigger problem. And then just 3 years ago, our largest employer in town, the Benco Corporation, which I'm not even sure how many it employed, but let's assume somewhere over 100 people running 2 shifts, up and surprisingly in the middle of the summer closed. And so that was probably an economic shot that we really didn't see coming. And so we're in the process of trying to recover from, it seems like, each decade facing a new crisis.
Right. Well, and I think we'll talk about this with Paul Lasley again in a moment. I think that there was a a sea change in life in Iowa in the 1980s that has led to a lot of trouble for a lot of small towns. But I want you to describe Main Street in Belle Plaine for me, say, 10 years ago.
Well, 10 years ago, I would say the city council probably made a decision to save cost on how they did the resurfacing of Main Street, so it almost seemed like Main Street had become a gravel road. You had numerous storefronts that were empty. You had merchants who were struggling. We were still fortunate. It seemed like we kind of had one of everything, but we didn't have anything new coming into town. Somewhere in that same time period, we lost one of our, we had a Ford Lincoln Mercury dealer in town. They closed up, and, you know, we slip into the 2000, the loss of Benco. There was restructuring going on. One of our largest historical employers was Funk's G Hybrids. It had changed hands several times. That particular business had shrunk down to, you know, it had been a business that had employed hundreds at one time, had shrunk way down. And so we were reeling 10 years ago. It was... I know the people who were on the city council and in the city manager's office were looking at Belle Plaine and saying, is there a way we can recover from this, or are we just going to watch our town population continue to shrink and buildings crumble on Main Street and literally fall into themselves?
And obviously a decision was made to take control of the future of Belle Plaine. Just this month, on July 2nd, the governor and lieutenant governor visited Belle Plaine to mark the completion of your downtown revitalization project. And that effort got started about 8 years ago?
About 8 years ago, I believe, we made our first application to become a Main Street Iowa program. And the first application was rejected. I believe their reasoning was we didn't cover a wide enough span of participants in the town. Our city manager, Bill Daley, who, by the way, last year was voted manager of the year in the state of Iowa, took over spearheading that committee, and within 2 years he got us into the Main Street Iowa program. And then with the help, the city council jumped in, and with the help of numerous people, they put together this project that was a streetscape project, which totally tore out every chunk of street and all the sewers and storm sewers on Main Street, and totally replaced that. And along with that, we're the only town in Iowa that did a facade restoration project, where we had, I believe, close to 30 Main Street businesses signed up for it, where we were going to restore the fronts of their buildings in the historical concept. Those two projects started about a year ago, April, and our merchants struggled through a long summer last summer with Main Street totally tore up. And in October, we had our ribbon cutting for the streetscape, and then on July 2nd, the governor and the lieutenant governor came in, and we had our ribbon cutting for the facade project, which, let's say, it's 99.9% done. There's still a few odds and ends to tie together, but they made this decision to move forward and battle the elements out there in the business world, kind of under the belief that if we fix it and improve it and have buildings that are repaired, that we will find the businesses to come in and fill those stores. And I think a prime example is one of our major projects on Main Street, a pharmacy group that's located out of Marengo, Iowa, has bought that building, put I don't know how many thousands of dollars into it, and they will open a new pharmacy on Main Street here sometime in August. Okay. At the same time, in this time span, the citizens of Belle Plaine voted a bond issue, to replace our aging swimming pool with a major aquatic center, which is just fantastic facility for our kids. And then the citizens, at the same time they voted that bond issue, voted a bond issue to put, I'm going to guess, somewhere around $10 million into our school system. They closed three buildings. They expanded our major elementary, and they expanded our high school to move the junior high there, and did several things with the athletic department, so including putting in a new 8-lane all-weather track. So we have had the public that have been very strongly involved in saying we want Belle Plaine to bounce back, and right now that's what we're trying to do.
Well, congratulations, Dave, and the town looks amazing. The reason we're talking to you right now is because I drove through several weeks ago and was blown away by the transformation in Belle Plaine. Dave Fish, the mayor of Belle Plaine, thank you for your time today.
Hey, very much. Anytime I can talk about Belle Plaine and anyone interested, yes, we have very vibrant Main Street. We have a new museum that just opened, and in late August we will open the Henry B. Tippey Annex to that museum. With if anyone's familiar with Henry B. Tippey, go to the University of Iowa. I believe the business building is named after him.
All right.
He's a Belle Plainer, and he's opening that. And so we're very happy with the progress and always glad to talk about it.
Well, thanks again, Dave. And now with us is Paul Lasley. He is professor and chair of anthropology and sociology at Iowa State University. Hello, Paul.
Good morning, Charity.
Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Indeed. Even it's a hot summer day here in Iowa.
Right. Well, let's go back to the farm crisis
Sure.
of the 1980s. For people who don't remember or who have actually forgotten, it was a very grim time in the state of Iowa. People were losing their farms. They were going bankrupt. There were suicides. There were even murders committed out of desperation.
Indeed. Perhaps one of the darkest periods in Iowa's history. Certainly the worst economic and financial crisis since the Great Depression. And in some ways, I think it may be exceeds what we experienced in the Great Depression. You know, it's sort of interesting that you tie the farm crisis to other sorts of crises that have affected Iowa's communities, generally natural crises from climatic change, floods, droughts, those sorts of things. The farm crisis differed in some respects because as an economic shockwave, there wasn't a consensus and agreement early on that there were victims, or if their fact was that people made bad choices and decisions. And I remember in those early days, we spent a lot of time simply raising public awareness of the seriousness of the financial crisis as it continued to engulf not only farmers and farm families, but as they tightened their belts, the impact that had on Main Street, on small businesses in our rural communities. And David did a good job of talking about the experiences of Belle Plaine. As farm families encountered financial uncertainty and hardship, the natural response is to tighten their belt. And as a result, it engulfed small businesses on Main Street. We've seen the serious out-migration in the 1980s. Iowa lost about 300,000 people. Unfortunately, many of those were our younger people that if we could have retained them in Iowa today, 30 years later, would have been community leaders. But many of them left the state in search of better jobs and opportunities and migrated to other states.
I remember the bumper stickers at the time, when the last one out of Iowa, turn out the lights.
Yeah, those are dark days. But beyond sort of the financial situation was really what it did to the social fabric of rural communities. You recall that we had the protest movements trying to highlight, and in fact, here on Iowa State campus, some of the activist farm groups. Prairie Fire was very active, the Coalition to Save Family Farms, and they planted crosses in the quadrangle of Iowa State University representing the demise of family farms and small businesses. We had tractorcades and protest movements that highlight the struggles of farm families in rural communities. But the emotional side, and that was an area that didn't get a lot of attention early on, was in fact the distress and how people tried to cope with the loss of income, the loss of livelihoods, in some cases the loss of a family legacy. Farms that had been in the family for generations were put up on auction, but represented shattered dreams and hopes of many people. And as the farm crisis took on a life of its own, it really moved from a crisis to a chronic condition. You know, oftentimes we talk about a crisis as something of high intensity but relatively short in endurance. But the farm crisis really engulfs about a 10-year period of time. So it really was a chronic. And as a result of that, many farm families encouraged their sons and daughters to pursue vocations outside of agriculture and farming. Many small businesses, as David just mentioned, closed. The sons and daughters of family-owned businesses on Main Street then took jobs in corporate America, oftentimes beyond the state.
And we still see that today, Paul. I mean, that Dave and I were talking about that. This really was a sea change for Iowa and for small towns in Iowa, because you can see the repercussions anytime you drive through the countryside now, can't you?
Absolutely. You know, because we really lost a generation of young people, not only on farms, but on Main Street.
And agriculture changed dramatically, too. This was when corporate farming really rose.
Well, yeah, there were a number of structural things, processes in place. And I think the farm crisis exacerbated or accelerated some of those existing trends that probably were rooted back in the 1970s in sort of those go-go years. You know, that's the other thing about the farm crisis that we had trouble getting people to understand, is that while some people were very, very seriously affected, others came through quite well. People that didn't have debt, had not expanded, or from, if nothing else, the luck of the draw. So it had a differential impact. And some people took advantage of that, and certainly as land prices declined about 60% during the 1980s, people that had cash in the bank or had access to capital moved in and bought up land and other farm assets at fire sale prices. And so some people's loss became other people's gain, which also then created for more tensions and turmoil in what I'd call the tearing of the social fabric, of the unequal impacts of tough financial times in agriculture. What I thought was interesting is we talk about the Belle Plaine experience and they're enjoying considerable success. You know, this is 30 years after the farm crisis. They're still rebuilding.
Right.
So, see, it's a long-term process.
And this is definitely a crisis that has shaped not just communities in the state of Iowa, but again, our entire state.
Absolutely. It changed the fabric of rural America and rural Iowa and many of our rural communities. And I think that's the thing about understanding disasters, is the long legacy and impact that it has for generations that follow.
Paul, thank you so much. We're out of time.
Well, thank you for having me, Charity.
Paul Lasley is professor and chair of anthropology and sociology at Iowa State University. Today we've been talking about communities in Iowa shaped by disaster. Our summer series continues through July with a look at Iowa cities and towns every Tuesday. This is Talk of Iowa.